everybody, and welcome back to the Elvis Reviews podcast. I'm Daniel here in New Orleans, and I'm here with Billy in Australia.
Hello!
And we are covering Elvis's first full movie soundtrack and his first real starring movie, Loving You.
Yes.
Yes.
First of all, just clear up a thing. We're saying this is the first soundtrack album, but I keep reading that this was somehow technically the second.
Well, because
so what's the thing there? What was really before this?
So they wanted to get Elvis in a movie, and they really rushed him into a part in a movie that was originally called The Reno Brothers. And Elvis is really not the star.
Okay, so it's not an Elvis movie.
The star is really probably a guy named Richard Egan or Deborah Padgett. I mean, Elvis is integral to the plot, but it's really, like I said,
but anybody could have played that guy.
100%. Whereas Loving You was tailor-made for Elvis.
Okay, so that's why I keep saying, well, it's the second soundtrack, and it's the...
And Love Me Tender did not get a full album.
Yes.
In fact, the third movie, Jailhouse Rock, the one after this, does not get a full album either.
Okay, so before Loving You, Love Me Tender...
Right. Love Me Tender was technically the first movie. It only had, I think, 5 songs. It was on an EP.
And it didn't have a soundtrack?
No album, just an EP.
Okay, that clears that up then. For anyone who was wondering, including me.
And if people are wondering if we're going to cover those songs, we'll either pick them up as the, you know, whatever songs we missed at the end, or a lot of these songs come out while Elvis is in the army. They stick them on albums, which we'll cover those.
Oh, okay.
So we won't miss any of them.
We won't miss them.
No.
So this was released June 20th, 1957.
Yeah.
According to the internet.
And I don't remember when the actual... I should have the date for when the movie came out. I know basically 1957 started out where I think January 8th or 9th, he makes his final Ed Sullivan appearance. So that's it for TV until Frank Sinatra in 1960, and then not again until the 68 comeback.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's just done his last television performance, and now he's just into the movies.
And it was 10 weeks at number one, Billboard Top Pop Albums chart.
Yes.
And
you watched the movie, right?
I watched the movie, yes.
Cool. So we have both
watched
the movie.
It's actually the first full Elvis movie that I've watched.
Well, it's the perfect one to start with.
I've seen like 10 minutes of like Charo or something when they were on TV, but I've never watched any full movie.
Well, I can promise you, Loving You...
I can promise. It's only downhill from here.
No, I was going to say that Jailhouse Rock is better than Loving You, and King Creole is better than Jailhouse Rock and Loving You. It's not until after the army he does G.I. Blues, and then it's really Blue Hawaii that seems like the real nail in the coffin as far as what the movies were going to be. Because, he comes out of the army, he does G.I. Blues, which is, it's like I don't know, it's not that great. But then he does Flaming Star and Wild in the Country. Neither one of them get a soundtrack album, but they're both really good movies. But then he does Blue Hawaii with 14 songs, and it's the biggest moneymaker. And so after that, the movies are all like filled with songs. And the plots become less and less important.
As soon as they're like, that's where the money is.
Yeah, they figured it out.
We can sell the soundtrack album.
But what did you think of the movie? Do you want to talk about the movie or just go through the songs and mention the movies?
We'll probably get
as it comes up
to bits of the movie as we go through. But
yeah,
overall,
that's what I was thinking.
My first impression was it's long.
Is it?
I think it was like an hour 40.
Okay.
And when I think of movies from like the 50s, they're all like 75 minutes. They're pretty short movies. But this was relatively long, I thought.
Yeah.
That was my first impression.
What else?
Did I like it? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well,
it was an interesting watch. You know, it was a good story.
Yeah.
It was. I did watch half and half. I watched half one day, half the next, because I'm like, it's just long.
Right.
And my attention span's not what it used to be. So I think I watched like 50 minutes and then another 50 minutes the next day.
Well, did you see the Zucker Brothers movie Top Secret?
Oh, 100 years ago.
Oh, okay. Because Top Secret, the movie that the Zucker Brothers made right after Airplane, starring Val Kilmer, is an absolute spoof of this movie, Loving You.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of other stuff thrown in, World War II movies, Blue Lagoon, there's a scene. But basically, Val Kilmer plays a guy named Nick Rivers, now that I think about it, where Elvis played Deke Rivers. But it's, some of the scenes are really similar to this Elvis movie.
Scene for scene.
I mean, you can tell from watching this movie, I mean, this is such a time capsule of 1957.
That was one of the things I really liked about it, because, new movies, they're all just, you know what they're like.
I do.
And it was so good just to see this is the time we're in.
Yeah.
When they were in the, like that diner and the guy tried to fight him and then he ended up singing a song. And it's just like, this is just amazing. It's you just like, you don't see that in a movie today.
Well, you know what's funny is you will see that same guy fight Elvis again in G.I. Blues.
The same guy.
And then in Girls, Girls, Girls. And then I think he's in Roustabout, although I don't remember him. Yeah, he pops up and fights Elvis in other movies. Just hysterical. Yeah, in fact, I remember specifically because it's a very similar scene in G.I. Blues where Elvis is actually singing with a band. And that same guy gets up and goes to the jukebox and plays a song. He plays Blue Suede Shoes by Elvis Presley. Uh-huh. Well, I was just saying, yeah, the same guy pops up and fights Elvis later in other movies, which is pretty funny. Well, I'll mention Loving You was the 12th biggest grossing movie of 1957, two places behind Jailhouse Rock, which was the 10th largest grossing movie of 1957.
That's pretty good. I mean,
hell yeah, it really
pretty
is.
Pretty much for his first movies to do that well. But then again, you might tell me there were only 18 movies released that year.
I didn't really pay attention. I don't remember even what was like number one.
Oh, but still.
Yeah, and he put out two movies in 1957, both of them top 20, Jailhouse Rock, top 10. The director, Hal Cantor, has done lots of other stuff. I think he did some like Bob Hope, Bing Crosby road movies. He's constantly has been involved with the Academy Awards, just like year after year. He's doing something with that. And I also wanted to say that he actually followed Elvis around, went and saw Elvis's last performance on the Louisiana Hayride. I mean, he co-wrote the script, and it was very, very, very much with Elvis in mind. I mean, this was really written for Elvis. And to kind of combat the, well, obviously, when you watch the movie, it's so heavy-handed. I mean, it's a defense of rock and roll. It's straight up, the kids who listen to this aren't bad, and the people who do it aren't bad, and you guys should just calm down.
Yeah, there was a bit of that.
Yeah, but that's about all. Well,
because it was only, I mean, rock and roll had only come in what, like a few years like earlier.
Yeah.
So there still would have been a lot of these older people saying, oh, this music, oh, what's it going to do to the kids?
Right. And that's what's so cool about the movie is it's like, wow, this is in the movie. Like, this is really what was going on. And the movie was like designed to help quell the outrage about rock and roll and stuff.
I liked the main lady who was his manager.
Elizabeth Scott.
Elizabeth Scott.
She did a bunch of movies in the 40s, and it's rumored that the movie All About Eve is about her. Apparently, she was like the understudy for Tallulah Bankhead and something, and they didn't get along. And supposedly, the movie All About Eve is about Elizabeth Scott and Tallulah Bankhead.
Ooh.
And then the guy, Wendell Corey, I like him a lot, too.
He was the main music guy.
Tex, Walter.
Yeah.
He's been in a ton of stuff. He actually,
I thought I'd seen his face somewhere. I had no idea where.
He apparently was like a really serious alcoholic, and you can't tell in Loving You whether he's drunk or not, but there are several movies I've seen. One of them, Women of the Prehistoric Planet, and then another called Astro Zombies. Yeah, he seems like he's pretty drunk throughout those two movies. I probably shouldn't. The guy, he died in 1968 of cirrhosis of the liver. He was a very serious alcoholic, but I loved him in the movie. I thought he was great.
Yeah, the thing that struck me about this movie, at some point, it might have been halfway through or at the end, I mean, it's almost inevitable now with our age and the age of the movie. And that's, you just watch it and then you're just like, pretty sure everyone on that screen is dead. And it's just a depressing thought.
I had that. I know exactly when I had that thought. I had that thought when the blonde, Elizabeth Scott, is talking to City Hall. And these guys are all in their 70s.
Oh, yeah. All the council guys. Yeah.
Because the one guy is saying, do I have to wear makeup if I'm going to be on TV? It's like that guy's.
Yeah, and they're all, what, in their 60s at least.
That guy's, been dead a long time, I'm guessing. One more thing I want to say about the movie in general is I definitely want to read this one review from the Monthly Film Bulletin. It described Presley's career as one of the most puzzling and less agreeable aspects of modern popular music. Presley adopts a slurred and husky style of delivery and a series of grotesque body gestures to impose on his otherwise innocuous material. In Loving You, he is allowed more scope and is at times both the cause and sum total of the film's doubtful entertainment value. That's
wow.
It. He was not beloved by critics.
I mean, Elizabeth Scott, to me, there's some, I don't even know how old she was in the movie. I don't care. Mm-hmm. But there was just, there's something so attractive about women from that time. And I don't know what it is.
Hmm.
Obviously, there's just something there that my brain says, oh, that's nice. I don't know what it is. Like, it's not necessarily even the look.
Yeah, I would like to
see. She had a deep voice. I noticed that. That could be part of it. I don't know.
Well, I guess she was in a bunch of like film noirs in the 40s. And I am tempted to check some of them out because, yeah, I liked her too. And I'm not like that era. I'm trying to, like, Veronica Lake is somebody else I think of who had the blonde hair kind of covering one eye and is in that same mold. But yeah, I'm just not familiar enough with those movies from the 40s. Like, this is the, I mean, this is the only thing I've ever seen Elizabeth Scott in. She's been in plenty.
Like, it could be that the attitude, the demeanor, the look, the voice. I don't know. But there's something there, and I'm just like, I like it.
Yeah. Well, she was probably the best character in the movie, if I had to really. I mean, she actually seemed like she had something going on and caused the plot to kind of happen more than anybody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She was pulling all the strings.
Integral.
That's another thing. With Hal Cantor, the director, following Elvis around, he also observed an awful lot of Colonel Parker. And I think a lot of Colonel Parker's stuff is in this movie, especially the way Elvis is sort of manipulated and is kind of kept in the dark and is just, you know,
and like, signed the contract for 50%.
Right. And the, like, that's
didn't even really know about it.
Selling me like a monkey in a zoo is one of the lines where, it's really, I think Hal Cantor sympathized with Elvis and saw Parker was kind of using him and treating him as a gimmick, kind of the way. Well, that's what they were saying in the beginning.
She referred to him as the gimmick for like the first half an hour of the film. Oh, and wait till you see my new gimmick.
And I can promise you Colonel Parker thought of Elvis as a gimmick for most of the 50s, probably. If not, maybe, I was going to say maybe his whole life, but definitely in the 50s. So I think that's all I have.
Okay. I read somewhere, I didn't go back and try and find it, but I read somewhere that Elvis's parents were in the film.
Yeah. You can see them. I was looking for him, but in that very last scene when Elvis comes back and does the TV show and sings Got a Lot of Living to Do. When he jumps in the audience, Vernon and Gladys are right on the aisle. I'm not going to be able to tell you without visually showing you. They're prominent. You can definitely see them there.
Yeah, we know what they look like.
And
look,
especially when Elvis jumps out in the aisle, Gladys is, you really just see the back of her, but she's one of the people clapping enthusiastically, like along with the beat and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it is. It is cool.
He would have been happy to have them in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other thing I've got, two things.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis liked that Wendell Corey guy so much, he named his pet cat Wendell.
I did not know that.
After him. That could be an internet rumor, but that's what it said.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure Elvis was allergic to cats, and there's a picture of Elvis with a cat and a typewriter floating around on the internet, and it's Elvis's face on Marlon Brando's body. I've gone back and found the original picture.
Oh, okay.
So that might be true.
Just be total rubbish.
I don't know for sure, but I do think he didn't have cats and was allergic.
You can't trust the internet these days.
But this was 1957. He might not have even known he was allergic until later. So he might have had, maybe Wendell is how he learned he was allergic, maybe.
Last thing I've got. Mm-hmm. On the very first day of filming, the Colonel somehow convinced producer Hal Wallace.
Yeah, Hal Wallace.
To pay Elvis a $50,000 bonus, which was three times more than Elvis's $15,000 signed contract to do the movie.
Yeah.
Again, is this just more internet lies?
Well, I don't know.
Or we'll never know.
Well, this goes back to the publishing rights. So when Colonel Parker arranged for RCA to buy the Sun Records, Elvis's contract from Sun Records, somehow Parker went to his publishing company, Hill & Range, and these two guys that owned the Abernacks, who are like these two Austrian guys that I feel like must have deep connections to Parker.
Yes.
They like put up some of the money for RCA to buy the contract. I don't know if that was simply to inflate the price, to make a big story, like, ooh, this is the biggest sale of a contract of all time. So I feel like Parker inflated numbers a lot. So I don't really know. We definitely do. In fact, on the very first song, I was going to do some talking about the publishing situation. But yeah, that sounds like something that maybe Colonel Parker had created, and just to look impressive. Kind of like the widow who dies and leaves Elvis the Cadillac in the in the movie. It's not real, but it looks interesting. It makes a good story.
So if any great listeners out there know if either of those two things are true or false, please let us know.
Yeah.
ElvisReviewsPodcast@gmail.com, because both of those things I want to actually know if they're true or not.
Yeah, me too. Especially the cat.
That's enough rambling. Let's go to a quite short album of under 27 minutes. Mm. We'll go side A, track number one. It's Mean Woman Blues, yes, written by Claude Demetrius.
Yes.
Depending where you look, it's around 2 minutes 15. And what are you going to tell me about this one?
Well, I was going to say that I would assume you probably have heard Roy Orbison's version, maybe even before.
Yes, yes, I have heard it. And then when I heard this, I'm like, I think I've heard this before. And then through all the reading, Roy Orbison recorded Mean Woman Blues, April 29th, 1963.
Right.
So a good like 5 or 6 years later. But yeah, I have heard that version. So it was good to hear Elvis do it.
And then Jerry Lee Lewis put it on the flip side of Great Balls of Fire. So the guy Claude Demetrius is one of the songwriters who signed with Colonel Parker's publishing company. The deal with Hill and Range, which later became Elvis Music and became Gladys Music, is they offered a 75-25% split to the songwriters instead of the customary 50-50. So if you were going to work for them, you were getting 25% instead of 50%.
Yeah.
And Hill and Range published several leading country artists, including Ernest Tubb, Bill Monroe, Hank Snow. 55, Parker took on Elvis Presley, orchestrated the buyout of his contract, secured substantial payments not only from RCA, but from Hill and Range. And although he was not a songwriter, Presley was guaranteed half the publisher's share of income from any Hill and Range song he recorded, plus one third of the songwriting share. With this arrangement in place, Hill and Range was for several years able to take its pick from songs written by some of the best songwriters of the era, Lieber and Stoller, blah, blah, blah. Claude Demetrius, in particular, he wrote the flip side to Heartbreak Hotel, so a song called I Was the One. He has...
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Mean Woman Blues, which not only got this Elvis recording, but Orbison and Jerry Lee Lewis. And then on the next album, the Christmas album, he's got a track on there, and he's got a big hit called Hard-Headed Woman coming up on the King Creole soundtrack. So he's like one of the big success stories. So even with that percentage, he's still became really successful as an Elvis songwriter. We have to think how many times these albums, especially the Christmas ones, get reissued and repackaged. Oh, yeah. And so even with 25%, I guess people were making money. So yeah, I haven't said a thing about the song itself, have I? I love the song. It used to bother me that the album opened with Mean Woman Blues instead of Loving You. But as an album, it's a good album opener and probably a better one than
Loving You is too slow to start with.
See, that's another thing. The movie has a much faster version of Loving You that I, over the opening credits, I like that version way better than the one they ended up using.
Because, yeah, when I listened to the album, we'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll get to that later.
I read that they had to splice this version between a studio take and one that was supposed to be for the movie. Since this time, years ago, Loving You has been re-released a bunch of times, and they've included all the outtakes. So there's a ton of other versions now.
What do I think about the song? First, do you think this is the best song on the album? Because almost every review that I saw talk about the first track like, oh, straight away, best song.
No, it never crossed my mind as being the best.
Me either.
I mean, I like it, but...
It's fine.
Right.
It's a good start to the album. It's okay. But so many people are like, oh, it's the best song.
Well,
in the whole thing, I'm like, I don't know about that.
Yeah. I mean, well, as we know, side A is the soundtrack and side B is a whole other thing. So if they're saying it's the best song in the movie, I could say maybe because it is.
Maybe.
It's probably the most authentic rock and roll song. It feels like the most legitimate rock and roll song on the album. So I'll give it that. I would say that.
I mean, it's good in the movie because it's got like the clapping parts and stuff and people get involved. But best song on the album, I don't know about that.
Well, see, I think this is an album that people point to when they say Elvis sold out. You know, the people that are the rock and roll purists who really like the Sun stuff. This is the album that frequently gets pointed to as this is where Elvis sold out. And even though I love Teddy Bear, I love Hot Dog, I love Party, I really like everything on side A. It is, when you compare it to the kind of dirtier, grittier rock and roll that we were talking about, like, you know, where guys are asking their women for money to pay the rent. It's a long way from that.
Yeah. Did you say this or did I read it? That this was where, like, the sanitization started.
Yeah.
Of Elvis to make him more, like, you know, likable and not this dirty rock and roll guy. Look, he's just a nice guy.
I mean, this movie does so much to sand off every rough edge of Elvis and rock and roll
as
possible. I mean, it's like it literally just sands all the edges off. So yeah, if that's what they mean by this is the best song on the album, and I'm not counting side B, if the best song as far as the Loving You soundtrack goes, I think that maybe that's maybe
well
that's
like you
true.
Said it could be the most
authentic
to what we think of as the early years of us rock and roll.
Yeah, and I think there's a reason why Roy Orbison and Jerry Lee Lewis covered this song and not, you know, Teddy Bear or Hot Dog or you know what I mean. I think the song does have a little more to it.
I mean, it's fine. It's it's up there. It's probably in the top seven. There's 12 tracks. I'd put it in the top probably three or four.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say it's the best on the album.
Yeah, I'm with you. Fun. It's a fun scene in the movie.
It's just a good rock and roll song. Mm-hmm. It actually got two guitar solos, which I found interesting. The first one's pretty average. Second one's a bit better. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just thought, oh, wow, look, there's a second guitar solo coming in at the end.
I had read that this was like they had to splice two takes together and one take was like meant for the movie. Whatever they did, I mean, I like the sound of it. Loving You has got a bunch of outtakes that are now available, so you can hear like the movie version of Mean Woman Blues, and there's a lot of outtakes from Loving You.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
They didn't lose all the tapes or destroy them or burn them or tape over them.
Well, once they get to the movies, luckily things seem to last longer. They're not being discarded the way, you know, outtakes of Hound Dog were.
So let's go to track two.
Yes.
In brackets, let me be your teddy bear.
Yes, the big hit song.
Cal Mann and Bernie Lowe. Oh, man. What do you say about this?
I know.
Number one hit during the summer of 1957. 7 weeks at number one. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the B-side was Loving You.
Yep.
I mean, the thing with this song is like literally the first 2 or 3 seconds and most people straight away know the song.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just that piano.
It's huge.
Just that piano bit. And everyone's like, oh, it's, yeah, I know this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a recognizable classic song.
It is.
It's a great vocal. Yeah, it is very soft compared to some of like the harder rock and roll stuff he's done. But still a great song.
I it's a classic, but it is pop, right? I don't think anybody could really call this
rock. Yeah, it is
rock.
More pop. Yeah.
And again, I don't think that's a bad thing. I love pop music. But yeah, this is sort of where Elvis, this album really broadens his horizons. And when we get to side two, I think it broadens him too much in some cases to where he went into things that weren't suited for him. But this this is perfect. And it is also, it's absolutely lyrically and everything else just designed to calm parents down. Like how can you be upset about it? He's singing about being a teddy bear. You can't say anything. And I love that. It's such an interesting, it's so transparent to look at it now at what they were doing, but seeing it in 1957 must have been a whole, I can't even imagine what it was like.
Here's the crazy thing. I didn't know that until right now.
Oh.
I had never thought about, you know, why did Elvis do this song? What's the reason behind doing this sort of song? And now you just said it's all those old people who were still scared of rock and roll.
And it's right there in the movie.
It's like, here's that same guy doing a nice little song about a teddy bear. Isn't it great?
Exactly. Yeah, this whole movie is just to calm everybody down about Elvis and rock and roll. But which is funny because the next one is Jailhouse Rock, and the one after that is King Creole, where he basically plays a hoodlum criminal, more or less. So this was the big one to calm everybody down, but he went right back to juvenile delinquency.
It was one attempt, and then after that, we're like, who cares?
Well, yeah, but then when after the Army, when G.I. Blues does the same thing that this movie is doing, that's the one that it starts to stick. So anyway, Teddy Bear, classic, but it is a pop song.
Yep.
And again, that's perfectly fine. It's a great song,
I'd
classic.
I never really thought to classify it like that, but it is. It's just a straight pop song.
Well,
I mean, it's just because of the era it was recorded in. You just write all that off as, it's rock and roll.
Rock and roll, right.
It's either rock and roll or a ballad.
Right.
You don't think about pop like back then. I mean, when I think pop, I'm straight away, I think like, really, I think 80s, but
I
probably 70s and 60s, if you want to go like Beatles or...
That's true.
You can classify that as pop, but you don't really think about pop back in the mid-50s.
No, but again, you can't call this a rock. I mean, there's no way anybody could call this a rock song or even a rock and roll song. Yeah, it's its own thing.
But
it's an Elvis song.
But then the crazy thing is it's the same band. It's the same band that just did Mean Woman Blues.
It is.
Which is rock and roll. So it's the same guys playing the same instruments, just a bit different.
I think this is also the album where they started to realize that Elvis could turn anything into gold, that they could give him any weird ass song, yeah. Elvis could find a way to spin it into gold at this point.
Even a dumb song about a bear.
Yeah. And I didn't look into it. I saw the songwriters, Cal Mann and Bernie Lowe. I never heard of them before. I don't know. I don't know what else they've done. Yeah.
They probably retired after that.
That's true. They might have.
With all the money coming in. Jeez.
Yeah. Even if they're getting 25% of it.
That's it.
Anyway, that's all I have about
Tim. The only other thing I wrote about this is, I don't even know if it makes sense. This is what I wrote. Great vocal. It's so smooth and slippery, and it just melts all over everything. I don't even know what I'm saying.
But after
listening to it a bunch of times, that was the vibe that I got.
Yeah.
If that makes sense to anyone, I don't know. But that's what I thought.
I was wondering if you were going to have a problem with the vocal, because it does, to me, it leans a little into that
jumpy.
The voice that you don't particularly like. Exactly. Just the real...
But the song is, I mean, it's so embedded in your brain that you just sort of ignore that part of it.
And the scene in the movie is great. I was lucky enough to see, there was a documentary in like 1981 or something called This Is Elvis. And one scene in the documentary was the whole teddy bear performance. So I got to see this on a big screen once. And amazing. That purple background and the red and white suit. Yeah, it made a hell of an impression. And I'm sure it did at the time.
If Loving You ever came to a cinema, I'd probably go and see it.
Oh, I would.
For $10, $15, I would go and watch that on the big screen. Well, because, I mean, we didn't even comment on that, but it seems very well filmed as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like cinematically, it looks really good.
I absolutely agree. And it really sucks that the first movies, this Love Me Tender is in black and white. This is in color. And then Jailhouse Rock and King Creole go back to black and white, which that's another thing. This is like the earliest color document of Elvis at all.
Mm.
I mean, he did a screen test where he mimed blue suede shoes, and that's in color. And that's it, except for this movie. Like in the entire 50s, this is like the only real color footage. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, again, you got all like the Ed Sullivan, all those early shows. That's all black and white.
Yeah. And even when he comes back and does the Sinatra show, he's still in black and white. So it's Loving You, and then not until G.I. Blues do we get Elvis in color again.
Holy moly.
I know. I don't know why in the world Jailhouse Rock wasn't in color. King Creole, you could make an argument about.
I reckon the only argument would have been the cost.
Probably.
It would have been a difference in cost between like the black and white film or color.
That is
And the
true.
Colonel would have said, what's half the price? Well, I think we're going black and white.
Right. That's right. This was like the first one they had to make the really big impression, but afterwards, maybe not. Although, like I said, King Creole, there's a reasonable argument because it was directed and produced by the same people who produced Casablanca. And it is kind of a noir, so it kind of looks cool in black and white. But Jailhouse Rock, I think, should have been in color. Anyway.
If only. Wait till some AI somehow will make a color version and we'll all be saying, wow.
There's a colorized version already. It's been around for a long time.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Anything else about Teddy Bear? It's got great backing vocals. Got to mention them.
Jordan Ayers are all over this album.
It's just such a catchy song.
It really is.
Even if you're not an Elvis fan, you would have heard this song hundreds of times in your life because it's just around. It used to be on the radio all the time, and it's in the culture. It's just there.
It is.
The zeitgeist, whatever the word is. Obviously less now, but it's been around for a long time.
I had thought it was by Lieber and Stoller just because it's such a classic. It seems like Lieber and Stoller. So I was surprised. Well, all these years, I just figured it was Lieber and Stoller. I didn't realize it was Cal Mann and Bernie Lowe. But
talking about Lieber and Stoller,
exactly.
Track number three. It's the name of the film, the soundtrack. It's Loving You. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller.
Yep. Big ones.
Reached number 15 on the US country chart, number 20 on the US pop chart, 24 on the UK singles chart. It did surprisingly well for a quite slow ballad.
Well, yeah.
It would have just all been on the basis of the movie.
The movie, yeah.
It's the name of the soundtrack, and people just would have said, let's get it.
Well, I do think it's so much better than Love Me Tender as a ballad, just in general. I think his voice is better. I just think it's a much better song than Love Me Tender. I mean, I don't know why I'm suddenly comparing it. Nobody said I had to, but yeah.
I don't know about that.
I mean, Love Me Tender is a classic.
I mean, I've heard Love Me Tender a million times, and I've heard this 10 times.
Right.
I don't know if I'd say it's better. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great. And I think we sort of write off Love Me Tender because it turned into a joke, and even he turned it into a joke.
Right.
But it's an honest, earnest
It's
song, it is, which it's doesn't sad. Really have a place in today's world. Everything's like sarcastic and a joke.
Right.
But I think it's, I'd say Love Me Tender's a better song.
Well, we will, if...
If you can strip away the joke part of it, which we've all seen and heard for a long time, I think it's a better song.
Yeah. Well, when we get to Elvis Gold Records Volume 1, which is very soon, might actually be the next one we cover, we will get to talk about Love Me Tender on that one.
Oh, there we go.
But yeah,
anyway,
I think part of my problem that I had with this one, I mean, I like it. I just was saying, I think it's better than Love Me Tender. But I saw the movie way before I had the album. I was like a little kid and I remember taping things using my tape recorder off the TV. Yeah. And so when the album came out and I heard this piano ballad for Loving You, I was really disappointed because the movie starts with this really up-tempo, upbeat version of Loving You. And then throughout the course of the movie, I think he does the song twice more. And once he does it on a farm with an acoustic guitar and like a quiet string section. Love that. And then I think he does it one more time, maybe on the television show before he goes into Got a Lot of Living to Do. But every version.
Yeah, he does a few right at the end there. Yeah.
No version in the movie is the version on the record. In fact, I don't even think there's a piano in any of the versions in the movie. So yeah, it was really shocking when I first heard this song because it's not in the movie technically. And it's one of those things, if you've ever heard a song done fast and then you hear a slow version, it's just like,
oh, the tape machine's slowed down somehow. It's broken. What have they done? How did they not notice this when they put it on the vinyl?
Well, like there's a Bobby Darin song, and in fact, album title, called That's All. And it's this great swinging, fast sort of swinging song. And then later I heard a version by Nat King Cole, which is earlier, but it's this really slow ballad. And it's just, I don't know, it's just weird, the juxtaposition between the fast and the slow. Loving You. I like it. I'd prefer it as a ballad to the first movie. I love the movie version. And like I said, now you can get all the outtakes, so you can get all those fast versions that I like better.
Yes. I will be straight to YouTube after this to hear the faster version.
Yeah, I definitely like the up-tempo version a lot more. But yeah, it is one of my favorite ballads up to this point, I think, that he's done. I think everything about this album shows a whole bunch of growth. This is what's interesting. I'm glad that we're covering the 50s in order, because really from album to album, you can just hear how his voice expands and how the music gets bigger and they give him more challenging songs to do. Like when we get to Lonesome Cowboy, I mean, we'll get to it, but it's just fascinating to see the leaps and bounds he seems to just grow by from album to album. It's like that run for me that Prince had in the 80s, where it's just like, each album is
just
such
evolves and
leaps
evolves
and bounds, man. Yeah. But that's all I have for Loving You.
I don't normally love the ballads, and I don't love this one, and especially because it's so slow. Yeah. But I still find myself liking this song because it's just, you know, that's the genius of the people who wrote it, Lieber and Stoller. It's just a good song. So, I really want to hear the faster versions,
even though
I heard it in the movie, but I just didn't pay attention.
Yeah. I wish Lieber and Stoller had really been around more in the 60s, because they wrote Loving You, they wrote Jailhouse Rock, and they wrote King Creole. So they wrote three title songs for Elvis. Yeah. And then I think publishing issues got in the way, and so them and Colonel Parker had a falling out. So after the Army,
tried to give them 25%.
Exactly. Yeah. And Lieber and Stoller realized,
and they said, see you later.
Well, they started producing the Coasters, I think, at this point. And the Coasters had Charlie Brown, and they had a bunch of other hits. So Lieber and Stoller were doing okay without Elvis.
Mm-hmm. So. But yeah, this one, it's just a good song. Another amazing vocal here as well.
It is.
Some nice piano, some guitar. I think there's some very basic drums in the mix, but it's buried. Like, it might just be a kick drum.
Yeah.
But there's something there.
Much.
And then that end little vocal bit and that last chord, that's just nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
It was a pretty common thing back then. You just end on, you know, this a chord with some, it's just got like one extra note in it, but it just makes you think, oh, listen to that. It's nice stuff. But that's all I got for Loving You.
Yeah.
So let's go to track 4, what I think could be the best song on the album, obviously. It's got a lot of living to do. Aaron Schroeder and Ben Wiseman.
Yes.
I love this song.
Oh, good.
I'm pretty sure this is my favorite song on this album. And I'm sure if anyone knows the sort of songs that I pick as my favorite song, you probably already guessed that it was going to be this one before you even press play. Aaron Schroeder and Ben Wiseman.
Yeah.
They also wrote First in Line, which was on the last album we did.
And I made a mistake that I have to correct, actually.
Corrections.
Yeah. When we talked about First in Line and I said Aaron Schroeder and Ben Wiseman had written a bunch of other Elvis songs, that part's true. But I said Can't Help Falling in Love was one of them.
Okay.
And neither one of them wrote any part of Can't Help Falling in Love. But I know why I made the mistake. It's because the guy's name is Ben Wiseman. And if I was a songwriter named Ben Wiseman, every song would start Wiseman Say, which is the way the way Can't Help Falling in Love starts. But actually, he has no connection to that song at all. So,
oh my God, that is hilarious.
It's Wiseman Say. It's got to be by Ben Wiseman, right?
Yeah, of course. Who else could have written it? Well, here's the thing about those two. Well, Ben specifically ended up writing 57 songs for Elvis. Not 58, 57.
Yeah.
No other songwriter wrote as many songs for Elvis as Ben Wiseman did.
Yeah.
So that's
a big one.
That's something. He would have made some nice coin, some nice bank, even if he was only getting the 25%. 57
right.
songs for Elvis. He probably retired quite early, you know.
I would think. Yeah. Well, he also co-wrote or wrote, I don't know, he might have written it all together. He wrote Crawfish and Follow That Dream, which were both not huge songs, but pretty big songs. Follow That Dream is such a great song, and it was never on a single, which drives me crazy because I think it would have been a great single. But yeah, this guy, the one we're talking about, Wiseman, he went to Juilliard.
There you go. Music Man.
And then the guy who was co-writing it with Aaron Schroeder, he wrote Big Hunk of Love.
Oh, what a combo. These two guys then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, I totally cut you off. You continue.
Oh, well, I don't know. Great vocal. Oh, you know, in this song where he says, come on, baby.
Yeah.
Who does that sound like? Is it like the Big Bopper or someone?
Oh, yeah. I know exactly which. Yeah, it is the Big Bopper in Chantilly Lace.
I had
Lace.
That in my head, but I wasn't sure if it was the right guy. Yeah, Chantilly Lace.
That's exactly
every
right.
Every time he says that, I'm just like, oh, that's just like that guy.
Mm-hmm. That was definitely a popular, that cracking your voice on the end of a note thing. And Elvis was really good at it.
Yeah, but this song, the energy is just great.
It
perfect. Tempo is perfect for this track. The only thing, apart from, of course, it could be longer, there's just one really horrible guitar note in this track.
Oh, okay.
And it's at about 1:16, just after he says missing, there's just this one guitar note in like almost silence. It's just this, and it's just like, oh, what? Who didn't catch that?
Yeah.
It sticks out so much to me, but still, great song. Just now when I hear that, I just laugh.
Right.
Because it's just like, did they do it on purpose? Was it just a mistake? I don't know, but it's still funny.
I got to check that out.
But it's a great song.
It is.
It's such a, like, I don't dance, but it's one of those songs that says, hey, you want to get up and dance? This is the song to do it to.
I agree.
Because it's just exciting. It's energy.
It is.
Anyway, that's all I got.
I love it too. I have heard it described as what Hollywood's idea of rock and roll was.
Oh, yeah.
Not that either of the songwriters were necessarily from Hollywood. I don't know where they were from, but I guess, I mean, I really like everything you said. I agree with. It's got a lot of energy and it's just fun. And that's one of the things about Elvis music in general. The ones that are fun are really fun.
And I think the important distinction there to say is it's good, clean fun. It's not this dirty rock and roll. That's why that could be part of the reason why this song is here. It's like, hey, we can do the rock and roll thing, but look, it's just about having a party. It's nothing bad.
Yeah.
It's of its time. Let's say that.
Yeah.
If you want to delve into the lyrics, let's just say it's of its time. It was fine then, I guess. Maybe not so much now if you want to 2024.
Yeah. There's plenty worse ones in the 60s, actually. But my biggest disappointment with this one is it doesn't use the same ending that it uses in the movie. The movie has the whole, and there's nobody I'd rather do it with than you. And it's really slowed down. And it's that typical Elvis ending, which we've heard on other songs.
Oh, yeah.
But
another one.
I think they use it on Party instead. But in the movie, that ending has definitely got a lot of living to do. And the only thing I can think of is it just sounded too suggestive. The whole, the only one I'd rather do it with is you. Is maybe it just was sounded too suggestive or something. But yeah, the ending on this is weird and it's a little bit sped up and it just doesn't have the dramatic ending that it should have.
Didn't want to scare the old people with that big bluesy rock and roll ending.
Yeah, but luckily it's available now. So, but yeah, I'm like you. And I think the movie itself knew that this was the fun song, because I think this was the one that got the most repetition in the movie. And it ends on this song. It's the big ending number.
I don't know if it's the best song. I mean, how do you even judge that? I don't know if it's the best song, but it's probably my favorite just because of the energy and the, you know, I mean, it's just straight rock and roll. It's just verse, chorus, you know, nothing amazing happens, but it's just, it's just a fun song.
It is. It's funny. One of his very last movies is called Live a Little, Love a Little, which reminds me of the lyrics to this.
Oh, yeah. Similar title.
Got Lovin' to Do. But yeah, this is, again, if you watch the... that movie Top Secret, you'll see the ending of this song getting used in one of the songs in that movie. But yeah, I don't have a lot to say. It's a fun, fluffy song. This is when they still cared about the movie songs and they were really making an effort. And it shows. It's much better quality than we'll get later on. In fact, probably much better quality than we'll get from the next two songwriters we're about to talk about, because Tepper and Bennett wrote a lot as well in the 60s.
So then we go track number 5, Lonesome Cowboy, Sid Tepper and Roy C. Bennett. Now, at about 3:07, I think this is the longest song on this whole album.
Probably.
Because it's a bit slow, but it does go on. It is. It is the longest track.
Okay.
Here we go with the big dramatic story song that he loved so much. And this is probably one of the earliest versions of it, really.
I think maybe the might be the first, really. That's this. I mean, I think this would be the most dramatic song he's done so far.
Mm.
I think.
Like, you got the intro, and then you just got that classic cowboy groove, that do 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 do, which I always find funny. It's just such a, it's just got such a hillbilly vibe. I love it. It
tumbling,
just makes me laugh.
Tumbleweeds. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just classic.
I thought about the Three Amigos a little bit. There's a song in the Three Amigos that's got that tumbling tumbleweeds kind of a vibe that some of the Lonesome Cowboy has.
I mean, I keep saying it, but another amazing vocal performance. I don't know how many takes he did of this to get it sounding like this, but it's amazing. It's great. Yeah,
I love it too.
Straight away, it's just after that sort of
whistling
groove starts. Okay. And then you get these backing vocals and they're like, ride. That reminds me so much of a song from Smile, Brian Wilson, Beach Boys.
Oh, okay.
I think it's Roll Plymouth Rock.
Okay.
And the backing vocals sing like rock, roll. And it's very similar because it's just one note. There's no melody. And it's like exactly the same thing, just different words. And it makes me think, I don't think I've ever heard Brian Wilson talk about Elvis, but he must have heard Elvis.
Yeah,
and was there a tiny piece of inspiration there? Because it's a very similar thing. It's probably not. I mean, it's just three notes, three words, but it just sounds very similar. It could even be the same key. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like anybody who was about that age, like the Beatles and the Beach Boys in the 60s, must have grown up on Elvis, really.
Yeah, it'd be a bit hard to avoid.
Yeah, so
I know Brian's a massive Four Freshmen fan, because, you know, you go back and listen to those albums and it's the way they did their vocals and like four-part harmonies.
Yeah.
And then you go and listen to what Brian Wilson did. It's like, it's exactly the same as what they did.
Yeah.
He just put it over like this surfing thing.
Right, right.
But it's crazy how similar when you go back and listen and compare the two styles. Anyway, this is the Elvis podcast.
Right.
I don't know if I can say anything else about this. I love this song. It's just, it tries hard to be atmospheric. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it quite does that, but it is very dramatic.
Yes.
And, you know, it's very, I was trying to think of another tick word, like operatic. It's like, no, it's not operatic, but I don't even have the words.
Yeah.
I like this song. I like the atmosphere it attempts to create. I don't think it quite gets there, but it's good. It's a good song.
I agree.
That's all I got.
I feel like we're in lockstep on this whole on this whole album, really. It's a great song. I have the same notes about I love how dramatic it is. I like that sort of that horse trotting rhythm.
Yep. They got the coconuts going.
Yeah, exactly.
Clip clop.
And I like the little bit of whistling that I don't know if Elvis is actually the one whistling or not.
Oh, yeah, I love that bit.
Me too.
I love the melody of that whistle. It's just really nice.
And I like in the movie, it's really dramatically lit as well. And it's so cool to see Elvis in 1957 in that same pose where he's holding his arm up like for dramatic effect.
Yep.
Just like If I Can Dream in 1968. Yep. And it's just so cool to see it's that same guy, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. What else can I say? I, it's another song where it feels like they're realizing anything they put in front of Elvis, he can do. And
even
this
hillbilly horse-trotting cowboy song.
This is not a typical Elvis song. Yeah. And he'll do it better than you can imagine.
Better than anyone else.
Yeah. And that's the other thing with this entire, a little bit with this movie, I feel like they think Elvis is country. Although in the movie, I think Elizabeth Scott mentions folk, like they just don't know what rock and roll is exactly. And they don't quite know what Elvis is. So they're like, is he like a cowboy? He's like, well, he's not really, he's Southern. He's not from the West.
Oh, and then she got the new suit for him.
Yes.
Big fancy clothes. Along. And he's like, what the hell is this thing?
Yeah. The other guy called it a Hopalong Cassidy suit.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think it's such an, this whole soundtrack is interesting because they're really still figuring out rock and roll, figuring out what Elvis can and can't do. And so far, there's nothing he can't do.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, like you said, there's a lot of atmosphere. It's just, I love the Jordan Ayers are doing more on this song, I think, than they've done on any in the past. I mean, they are really, it's almost, it's not a duet, but the Jordan Ayers are doing a lot of work. Yeah, it's just a great song.
And they were in the movie too, weren't they? Because I think
they are.
He even mentioned them at one point.
They do get mentioned.
Someone mentioned them by name.
Yeah, in fact, what's cool is Scotty Moore, Bill Black, DJ Fontana, they're all in the movie. Although I think only Bill Black has one line, and it's about a parakeet. But like I said, this is such an amazing document of Elvis in color in the 50s, and this is the only one there is, and it's got, like I said, it's so cool to have Scotty and Bill and DJ and all of them up there.
So were they the actual band, or were they just sort of extras just hanging around?
They were the actual band, but of course on the album I think it's augmented by a lot of other, there's a piano player for sure,
so
on
that
Teddy Bear
on stage thing right at the start. That's them on the stage with Tex, right?
Right. So Tex and the guy whose guitar string that Elvis keeps breaking. Those are actors. And I think there might be one other guy on stage with a saxophone or something who is an actor. But the guy on drums is Elvis's real drummer. You can see Bill Black on the upright bass, Scotty Moore on the guitar. So, yeah, his real band is up there, which is
cool. See, I'm just not that familiar with those guys. If it was the later band, like with Ronnie and Scotty and Glenn, I'd know them if I saw them. But these guys, I've seen them so little, I just didn't recognize them.
But yeah, same guys that he was playing in Las Vegas with, the year before and pretty much flopping. It's, same guys.
So that's the country song.
Yep.
That's the cowboy song.
Yep.
Let's go track 6. It's Hot Dog by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, okay, first of all, 1:13.
That's what I was going to ask,
give or take a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
Man.
Barely.
It's so short, but then I thought if it was any longer, it wouldn't work.
Because
there's so little to the song. It'd just repeat the same thing anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they could have put like a solo, guitar solo, sax solo, something.
Yeah.
But no, that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's another big up-tempo track.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've already said you like this song, but I would say here is the proof that not everything these two guys wrote was amazing.
Right.
I mean, it's not awful. I don't dislike it. It's just, it's not amazing.
Yeah. Well, I have fun 50s fluff written down because it's fluff.
I mean, they probably just chuck this out, in their sleep. It's just so simple.
Even in the movie, I feel like the song is only really used as like part of a medley. So it doesn't even.
It is just a throwaway thing. Just to fill in a minute and a half.
Yeah. I mean, it's two great songwriters at their peak in the 50s writing fluff. So it's good for what it is. But yeah, it's not much of a.
Were the songs written for the movie?
This one.
Or did they pick from songs?
Because,
they might have gone to Jerry and Mike and said, look, we just need like a minute, just a fast, jumpy thing.
I think
they probably chucked it out in half an hour.
That is
hot dog. It's about hot dogs. It's at the fair. Okay, easy, done.
That's probably what happened. In fact, on like the Christmas album, when they write Santa Claus is Back in Town, I know for a fact that they were locked in a hotel room by Colonel Parker until they came up with a song.
Oh, wow.
At this point in the movie, I don't know if there's just a bunch of people submitting songs, if they were, or I don't know how much like detail they were given about, we need a song for this specific scene. Because in this movie, especially, no song feels especially, what's the word? Circum- substantial. Like it doesn't feel like, I'm trying to think, like later on in the movies, you get songs that are very specific to a situation.
To the scene. Yeah.
Yeah. In this movie, there really isn't any of that. All of these songs, even a minute 13, it stands on its own as far as not being, you know, it's not about being in a sports car and trying to rumba. Like, yeah, like yeah. In Fun and Acapulco, a song called No Room to Rumba in a Sports Car. Like, they're not that specific yet. So yeah. I don't know if they were really, I'm sure they were asked to contribute to the movie, but it was probably just more broad.
Mm.
Like you said, like, yeah, we need a minute to fill. Can you do something? That kind of thing.
This song, not strongly, but it reminds me of Viva Las Vegas, the song.
Wow, that is not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say Mystery Train.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I could sort of hear that too.
Just the rhythm.
There's just something about the atmosphere that it creates with that.
Yeah, I can hear Viva. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, never thought about it, though.
There's just something there. My brain always does that. It'll just hear like two or three notes and it'll like, that's like that other song.
Right. Well, I did that with this song, but to me, it reminds me a little bit of a song on the G.I. Blues soundtrack called Frankford Special, which during the recording of it, they did fast and slow versions of it. But it's a song about a train, and it has the Jordanaires doing some real similar train kind of.
It is, noises. Yeah. It's a like chug along yes. train sort of thing. Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, I that's definitely. When you hear the song on G.I. Blues, I think you'll recognize Hot
Dog. I'll be like, oh, that's that same thing again. What yeah, was exactly. that other song we talked about 6 months ago?
Yeah.
So that's Hot Dog. There yeah. we go.
Last track of the soundtrack, technically.
Track 7. It's called Party by Jesse May Robinson.
Yeah, I like this one.
Now, this was released as a single in the UK.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Peaked at number 2 on the singles chart. So there you go.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Okay, the lyrics. Are you ready for the lyrics?
I don't even understand.
I've never kissed a bear. No. I've never kissed a goon, but I can shake a chicken in the middle of the room. That is one of the best lyrics.
Yeah.
Some people might disagree and say that's awful, but I just love lyrics that are just so stupid and they're so fun to sing.
Yeah.
That's the best thing about it. You could sing along to that. It's great.
I can't understand what he's saying during one part of it, though. The meat is on the stove. The bread is getting hot. I don't know the next line. Like, I've read it and it doesn't seem correct, but it's something about, or everybody come and taste the possum something. I don't know. I can't understand what he's saying, but it's a fun song.
It's everybody come and taste the possum something something.
Right. The possum something slop. Or
it sounds like on the shot, but that doesn't make sense.
No, but I've never understood what the heck he's saying there either. I got as far as you with the possum something slop.
Everybody possum, come and taste slop. The possum. Yeah.
Yeah.
But. What a song. I like the little high notes he does.
Yes.
Which is very, is it Little Richard?
And the Beatles, yeah.
Just chucks in those high notes at the end of every...
Very Paul McCartney.
Yeah, yeah.
They all got it from Little Richard, but very Paul McCartney.
Yeah, what can you say about this? It's just another upbeat, it good is. Song.
And this one, they used the ending that should have been on Got a Lot of Living to Do.
Yes.
This actually has the ending, but in the movie it doesn't have that ending. So it's very weird. Yeah, I like the song a lot. I think along with Mean Woman Blues, it's one of the two more sort of authentic rock and roll songs.
Also very short. Not even a minute and a half. 1:26, roughly.
Yeah. I had a weird thing happen with this song. In 1984, the World's Fair was in New Orleans, and they had a big amphitheater where whoever was on tour would play the amphitheater, but you'd have to buy separate tickets to go see the concert. And anyway, I was at the World's Fair while the Go-Go's were playing, and you can hear them playing, and suddenly I recognized the song Party. I'm like, is this the Go-Go's singing the Elvis song Party? You know, years later, once I had the internet, I looked it up, and sure enough, the Go-Go's have done Party live like a bunch of times. So it was really cool hearing Belinda Carlisle singing Party. And I think you can find it on YouTube. Maybe not the 1984 version, but other versions of it. Yeah,
that's a good song. Let's play it.
It is. That's what I mean. I think this is much more of a real rock and roll song. I love the Little Richard style Paul McCartney ooze as well. Yeah, that's just so cool. And it's such a classic rock and roll sound. Yeah. It's a fun song. It's pretty much Hot Dog and Party. You could have put them together into one song and it would have been fine with me. Because they're both short and they both kind of feel, they're both fluff, but really fun 50s fluff. Yeah, that's it. That's all I've got. And even though we're just finishing side A, that's
the movie.
That's the soundtrack. yeah, everything else is a bonus
like,
song.
So many reviews that I read were just like, side A is pretty good. Side B, it sort of starts to fall down.
Yeah, I have issues with side two.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's go. Side B.
Yes.
Or if you've got a CD, whatever number.
Right.
But on the vinyl, it's side B, it's track one.
Track one.
It's Blueberry Hill.
Yes.
Obviously done by...
Fats Domino.
Fats Domino.
Yeah.
Written by Vincent Rose, Al Lewis, Larry Stock. Now, don't tell me this is Al Lewis.
From the Munsters?
Grandpa from the Munsters. It cannot be.
That would be hysterical if it were. No, it can't be.
I need to look into that, because if that's true, that is amazing.
Yeah, there's almost zero chance of that, I'm going to say.
I'm guessing Al Lewis is a pretty common name, but... Al Lewis, that's who I think of.
That's funny.
There's another job for our great listeners. Can anyone confirm if it's that Al Lewis or not?
Yeah, well, actually, this was done... I always thought this was, you know, a Fats Domino song. I thought he wrote it. He didn't. I didn't know it was recorded by Louis Armstrong and Glenn Miller. So this song is way older and have been covered way more times. Elvis's version, I have read and agree with the quote that this is one of Elvis's most lackluster covers that he's ever done.
Yeah. I don't think many people could disagree with that. It's just so uninspired.
Yeah, he does not put his stamp on it.
It's just like, let's just get this done and I can go home.
And I had a theory about that, but my theory is blown to hell because Fats Domino isn't the writer. I thought, based on the lack of passion in the song, or the lack of, not, that's not the right word, the fact that Elvis does in no way make this his own, which is, you know, we say this all the time that once Elvis records it.
Didn't even try.
Not even a little. And so I thought, you know, maybe he recorded this to just, because he likes Fats Domino and this will send some royalties Fats Domino's way. But
the truth.
He didn't write it. So other than the fact that Elvis liked it, I don't know why he recorded it. He didn't do anything with it. I mean, it's not terrible. And if you'd never, ever heard the earlier version, you might like it a lot. But to me, yeah, it's a shame because it's obviously a song I like. It's, you know, it's a New Orleans song. But yeah, Elvis just does not do much with it. It's weird. It's very weird.
It's just such a standard. Yeah, you said lackluster.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. It's Elvis. His voice is good. Mm-hmm. But there's just nothing there.
Yeah.
There's no attempt to put any sort of life into it. No attempt to Elvisify the track. It's just like, I'm just doing this for whatever reason.
And he spent two different recording sessions, he like returned to it. And so, in the first recording session, he did two New Orleans songs. He did One Night, but it's the one Night of Sin, the one that was the original that they didn't release. And he did that and then followed it with Blueberry Hill. Wasn't satisfied. So both songs got re-recorded. One Night, of course, with the new lyrics. Yeah, I don't know why it took him two different times to come up with this version of Blueberry Hill. It's just so...
To come up with such a nothing version.
Yeah, it's interesting in illustrating what I've been saying about the difference between rock and roll coming from New Orleans versus rock and roll elsewhere. And it's that piano, that very standard sort of slow beat that is sort of New Orleans rock and roll versus other rock and roll. I mean, it all comes together eventually, but other than the fact that it's neat that Elvis recorded it, it's just there.
Well, the strange thing is that he's singing about, he found his thrill. It sure doesn't sound like it.
Yeah.
There's no thrill in this song at all.
Yeah. I have no explanation. I really don't. Said when I came up with that theory that he just wanted to do it because he liked Fats Domino, maybe Elvis himself thought Fats Domino wrote it and maybe he really did record
possibly
it for the reason I was thinking, because I can't think of any other reason that it makes any sense for him to just record this song. But honestly, there's a couple of the next track I have questions about as well for why Elvis recorded it. So yeah, like, side two is weird.
I can't say anything other than if his goal was to record just like a standard version of this, then job done. He did it.
Yeah.
Nothing stands out. It's just a straight through. Yeah. That's the song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, there was another version of this, which I think was released on one of the...
The live? We're talking about Elvis again?
Like, no, there was like an acetate version, which sounds like an earlier version. I don't know. It sounds it's a bit slower. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different recording. It's just more raw and bluesy than this one. And I'd say it's better.
It probably... Yeah.
His vocal performance is not that different. It's still pretty standard, but the band just sounds a bit more interesting.
Right. There are a bunch of outtakes of this. And I've got a bootleg CD somewhere that's got like all of them, but I haven't listened to it in years and I don't even know where it is. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there's got to be a better version of it that he recorded.
Anyway, let's get past this Blueberry Hill.
Yeah, we have another really big composer coming up on the next track.
Cole Porter, track number 2, True Love by Cole Porter.
Yeah, my notes are just a bunch of Z's.
This is the first song on this whole album where I really just wanted to hit the skip button.
It was
it's a whole lot of nothing to me.
It makes no...
I'm sure there's people out there who love it, or at least like it, but I'm not one of those people.
It makes no sense that Elvis recorded this to me. It came out only the year before by Bing Crosby, and it was in a movie called High Society, which is a really good movie with Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Grace Kelly, I think. And it makes perfect sense in the movie for Bing Crosby to be singing it. He's singing it on like his yacht. Well, the movie's called High Society. It's like these very upper crust people. And it makes no sense for Elvis to be singing a song about feeling far above par. I mean, what the hell? That's insane. It doesn't make any sense to me that he recorded it. The only thing I can think of is just like the rest of the album. They're like, hey, we need people to know you can do serious songs. Why don't you do this Cole Porter song? Bing Crosby, you did it last year. So all I can think is people are convincing him that he needs to do these songs to prove something. Because otherwise, I never listen to the song. I mean, I find it one of the most boring things he's ever recorded in his entire life.
Like, we know this second side of this album. It's just a bunch of random songs collected that he'd recorded in the last year or something. And they just had to make it just to fill up the rest of the album.
Well, I don't think that's... No, I think these were recorded specifically...
Really?
I think so. I mean, maybe not the last track, I Need You So, might not have been. But yeah, I think these were meant to fill out side B of this.
But they weren't... I didn't think they were specifically recorded for this.
For this album?
I thought they were just stuff that he'd recorded recently, and they're just like, well, we've got to fill up the rest of this album. Just grab this and this and this and
chuck it in there. You might be right. I mean, they were kind of recorded all during the same sessions, which makes me think they knew they needed a certain number of songs to fill out the album.
Possibly.
I might be wrong because they really, I could be dead wrong. But it's the only reason the song makes sense to me is that just like the movie was trying to show Elvis in a very different light, the only reason I can think for Elvis to ever record this song is to convince people he could do like a Bing Crosby song or, a Cole Porter song.
He could have at least sped it up a bit or something.
Oh my, just anything. It's
anything
just like,
would have been better than what it is.
It's just like Blueberry Hill. There's no effort to make it his own.
Yep.
I do think after this song, the rest of the, there's only 3 more songs, but I think all 3 of them are better. These first 2 songs on side B are just very weird recordings.
Like, we're 2 for 2 for the boring songs on this side.
I'm done with the boring songs.
Track 3, Don't Leave Me Now. Aaron Schroeder and Ben Wiseman again.
Yep.
Wiseman say.
Yep.
Also wrote, got a lot of living to do.
Yeah.
The start of this song reminds me so much of another song. Just like literally the first line and a half that he sings.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same melody as another Elvis song from later, which I've been thinking about it for like weeks and I cannot figure it out.
Well, this is an odd song because he re-records this song for the very next movie, Jailhouse Rock. And the re-recorded version is the one that gets released on the Jailhouse Rock EP. So it's odd for him to do that, to return to the song. I mean, he did it once or twice, but... Yeah, it's a weird one.
This is probably the best of the first 3 tracks.
It's
fine. It's a good vocal, nice backing vocals. But again, it's nothing that's blowing me away. I don't even have anything else to say about it. It's just like this side B, I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I like it better than you, I think, because I feel like it gets a little bluesy, which I like. And we haven't heard anything even a little bit bluesy so far. So I do like that it kind of gets into slightly bluesier territory. And I think not the next track, but the one afterward is another one that's way more bluesy. And I really like that about it. The song in the movie Jailhouse Rock is the fictional character, Elvis's fictional character in that movie. It's his first single. And it has some weird, there's like a bunch of different versions in Jailhouse Rock as well. So yeah, I like it. It's not amazing, but I think it's a return to the quality of Side A.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say it's up there with everything on Side A.
Yeah, it's better.
Yeah, so.
So let's go to track 4, Have I Told You Lately That I Love You, by Johnny Russell and Scott Wiseman. Wiseman's A.
Again, yeah.
Now, this is not Van Morrison. This is not Rod Stewart.
I know.
So many songs with this name.
Mm-hmm.
It's not those.
No. I would love to have heard Elvis do the Rod Stewart one. I mean, not when he's 21, which is how old he is here, but later in life, I wish he would have recorded the Rod Stewart one.
That would have been interesting. Yeah,
because
I can see him singing that.
Me too.
Yeah, he likes that sort of sappy sentiment at times. I could see him singing that.
Yeah, but like you said, this is not it.
But yeah, this one, it's pretty average, I think. Mm-hmm. From what I could find, the original version first released was by Bing Crosby, who we just talked about. Bing Crosby, yeah. Bing, blah, Bing Crosby, Bing.
Bing Crosby and Gene Autry.
I cannot even say this. Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters.
Ah.
I listened to that one, and I think I actually prefer that version.
Oh, I didn't listen
just
to
because
it.
It's got better harmonies, it's got some strings on it. And again, Elvis's version is just not making it anything more than it is.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't make it an Elvis song. He just sang it. And that's it.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else about it. I prefer the Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters version of this.
I don't know why I haven't gone back and listened to that. I'm going to have to. And if I do, I might also prefer it. I do like this one. Again, I feel like these last three tracks on side B are much better than the first two. It's just kind of a nice... It's a nice tempo. It's just kind of easygoing. It is kind of background music more than some of the others. I mean, it's totally inoffensive. I wouldn't skip it. It's not worth skipping. Yeah, it's a nice track. The Jordan Airs sound good. Elvis sounds good. Yeah, I hate to just call it inoffensive because it's better than inoffensive, but it's not a lot better, you know?
It's just one step above being inoffensive.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah, I never skip it. Unlike True Love. True Love is intolerable to me to get through. Yeah, it's fun. It's kind of like, I don't know, I was going
to
say
it
was...
Look, we don't have to like these songs. We don't have to like everything.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like I don't like it, because I really do like it. I just don't love it. It's just kind of there. It doesn't jump out like a lot of Elvis things do. I'll say that.
Well, I've got similar thoughts about the next song. So it's the last track of the album of Side B. It's I Need You So, by Ivory Joe Hunter.
Yes.
And I've heard that name somewhere before.
Well, we've heard it because Elvis has covered... Well, the two songs that he covered that we already talked about are I Will Be True and It's Still Here, which he did on that album Fool. Was that the one? Yeah, it was on that album. And it's just... What's interesting about those two songs is it's just Elvis playing piano and no other accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he did I Need You So. He did a song called My Wish Came True. That is to say, Ivory Joe Hunter wrote these songs and Elvis recorded them. Also, Ain't That Lovin' You Baby, which is a really cool song. Just reminds me a little bit of the Otis Redding song, These Arms of Mine. I don't know if you know that. I
don't know that one.
It's a blues... And that's what I like about the song. This is as close to Elvis gets to blues on this entire album. And it makes me want a full blues album. I just think Elvis, his voice was so good at this. While visiting Memphis, Tennessee in the spring of 1957, Ivory Joe Hunter was invited by Elvis Presley to visit Graceland. They spent the day together singing. Hunter commented, he's a very spiritually minded, and he showed me every courtesy, and I think he's one of the greatest. That's just a little quote from Elvis. Didn't often meet the songwriters, so it's kind of cool that he had a connection with this guy. Yeah, all I can say is I do like it. There's a song called Tell Me Why that was recorded at the same session that really would have been good as the last track on this album if that had added like one more song.
Oh, I think I heard that one too. Yeah, it was added to like later bonus versions and stuff.
Yeah, I ended up listening to a YouTube version of the album that had Tell Me Why as the last track.
Yes, I listened to the same one.
I listened to it like 6 times before I realized that wasn't on the album.
Yeah.
Because I remember thinking, oh man, side two has really picked up. These two really cool blues songs at the end. But no, it's just this one. But I like it. I think it's maybe the best track on side B. Maybe? Yeah, I can say
that's
that.
It's a pretty low bar.
Maybe so. But yeah, if you check out that Otis Redding song, These Arms of Mine, I think it's from the late 60s. It's another really good blues song that has some similarities. But that's I can say.
I don't mind this one. It's also not great. Mm-hmm. Elvis's vocal is fine. It's nothing outstanding. One thing I noticed was the drums seem to be mixed pretty loudly on this for some reason.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, but the drums are just like right up there. Backing vocals are good. Yeah. This just, to me, this just sounds like Blueberry Hill again. It's just another studio track just recorded for the sake of it. Nothing interesting happened, but there's just one more song they can use to fill up an album.
I feel like especially during the two parts in the song where Elvis does the... I just know that there's these two parts in the song where he kind of, the music stops and he's like, when the day is done, you're right about the drums.
They're really loud.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why.
Yeah, no, I like his vocal on this a lot when I go back and listen to it. In fact, I might like it better than any vocal on the album, to be honest, just because I just love the way he does these songs with the blue tint. And there's two parts in the song that where he almost yells. I can't remember if it's like when the day is through, I need you so. Yeah, there's a couple of parts where he really gets into it. Yeah, no, I have to say this is one of my favorites. And I think maybe this song, if it were in a different setting, you might like it better as well. Like if it was between two other bluesier songs.
Mm.
Somehow me hearing Tell Me Why after this somehow improved my view of this somehow. Like
the only thing that is sort of, I guess, disappointing is that we don't have a lot of live versions of any of these early things.
Only Teddy Bear, and you know how he treated Teddy Bear. He ran through it.
Yeah, but a couple of these would have been, if not good, at least interesting to hear.
Well, he
live
did
on stage.
He did a little tiny bit of Blueberry Hill on the medley from the Memphis concert.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember that long medley? It had Flip Flop and Fly. And so he did a snippet of that. Well, obviously, Teddy Bear. He almost sang Loving You a couple of times. Like there's a few concerts in 1969, like when he first got back on stage, and he'll screw around with the guitar and he'll sing like the first line or two of Loving You.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I even remember him specifically doing like a couple lines, the audience applauding and him saying, I ain't going to do that song. And then going into a whole different song like Poke Salad Ann or something. So, yeah, you're right, though. He doesn't return to these very much or at all.
No, this song is just so it's... As someone once said, it's just a song.
Yeah, I've heard
it's
that.
There's just nothing there that I find interesting.
It's
nothing stands out. It's just a song you recorded in the studio one day and then never thought about it again.
Maybe. Well, only because he had the relationship with the songwriter, I think he... Well, I just don't know. I feel like this is a song he would have gone back to and maybe had been playing before he even recorded it. It just has that lived-in sound to me.
Mm.
The part I was talking about, it's when he says, when the day is done, and then there's a break, and then he says, I need you so. There's two parts in the song when he says that. The first one is pretty normal, but the second one, when he comes back in with the, I need you so, he hits a higher note. It's a really cool part of the song.
Oh, I'll give it one more go.
It's not single material. It's not a song that I imagine would have charted. It's not, you know, I'm not saying it's a great pop song or commercial song, but this is the kind of stuff that I especially love hearing Elvis sing. So maybe that's why I just like when he does anything.
It fits that style that you want to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's got a more stripped down, the music is way more stripped down. And I think I like the louder drums. I think it kind of gives it something.
Yeah.
Hey, that's all I got.
That's the end. So it's the outro, it's the conclusion. I just found one review which made me laugh, and I've just got to read it. And it references the previous album we did.
Oh, okay.
And it basically just, this is what it said. This is the quote. It's a kind of short album, but it doesn't have boring songs about dead dogs. And I just thought that was the best review I could have read.
It's a great review. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I just thought that was so good. I couldn't stop laughing. I'm still laughing about it now.
Anybody not familiar with Elvis's full catalog, I can promise you there are no more dead dog songs. There's just one. Yeah. No others. So, well, that's a great quote.
So that's it. We did the first
full soundtrack album.
Technically, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it is a bit of a weird one because it's really only the first seven tracks are from the movie, and the other side B, the other five tracks are just a bunch of songs. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, like you said, some of the other soundtracks just got an EP. Maybe this should have just been a seven-track EP. I don't know.
I think it could have easily.
Because it could have fit, because the songs are so short. It could have easily fit.
And they did release two EPs, Loving You, Volume 1 and Volume 2. It doesn't have everything on it, but it has... I think it is all songs of side A. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a weird one.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. Yeah, side B sort of, like most of the reviews I read, side B is sort of obviously just not as good as side A.
Yeah.
I probably won't listen to anything on side B again.
Yeah.
But I am going to listen to Party and Hot Dog.
Right. And check out the fast version of Loving You.
Of Loving You.
The up-tempo.
Got a lot of living to do. I'll even listen to Lonesome Cowboy again.
Yeah.
And of course, Teddy Bear and Mean Woman Blue. So pretty much every song on side A.
I agree.
Is a decent, at least at the minimum, a decent song, if not good or great. But side B is just, it's just a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Would we be still saying that same opinion if we didn't know that the songs on side B were just a random collection? That's the thing. Your brain gets like, your thoughts get colored by information.
Yeah, but...
And then it's hard to think, well, what if I didn't know that? Would I still think that way?
Well, to me, I would have to say yes. And the reason is because side B should be the better side, right? I mean, side B, you got songs by Cole Porter. You've got hits by Fats Domino. You've got, you know, tried and true classics. Side A should be the bad side where they just wrote a bunch of songs for an Elvis movie.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Because that's the way that you think. Like, the movie soundtrack songs aren't that great. And here, this album proves the opposite.
Exactly. We're complete in agreement on this album. Yeah, side B is where it really, really hits a wall.
It falls off the cliff.
Well, again, for me, the last three tracks are all...
Okay.
Are as good as... For me, the last three tracks are as good as side A. But those first two... Especially True Love. True Love is just a song he never should have recorded. I mean, he just shouldn't have. The lyrics don't suit him, especially he's 21.
Again, it just doesn't make
feeling
sense.
Feeling far above par. Elvis couldn't have even known what that meant. He had to ask somebody probably. Like, what is this, a golf term? I mean, it's bizarre.
wasn't there another song that Elvis recorded just because, like, the Colonel's wife liked it or something?
Are You Lonesome Tonight? But that became a huge hit.
Yeah. Well, this could have been another one. Maybe someone that...
Well, he could have tried.
Maybe it could have been something like that. It's like, oh, what's he likes this song? Do that one. Okay. Yeah. Yes, boss.
We didn't mention covering it, but there is a part in here where there's a harmony where I guess he's doing a straight-up duet with one of the... Jordanaires, which is interesting because it is the first track I've heard him do a real harmony vocal. But yeah, it's still boring. Side A is the
first soundtrack. Overall, it's fine.
Yes. Movie as well.
I'm not going to give it a 6 out of 10 or something, but it's okay. Yeah. There's some good songs. There's some not so good songs. Like, I guess, any album, really.
True.
So, what else?
Yeah, I like it. And when we get to the next full soundtrack album, really is a full soundtrack album. Every song, side A and side B, from the movie.
Okay.
And that's King Creole. And that's the one, again, Lieber and Stoller, I don't remember how many tracks they wrote, but they wrote a lot of King Creole, I think. So it's actually a really good soundtrack.
So talking about what's next.
Yes.
I think you mentioned something about a Christmas album, which doesn't make a lot of sense if we do it in like May.
I agree.
So maybe we could leave that one till a bit later.
Right.
Still in the 50s era, but we can do that like near the end of the year. That would make sense. So then what would be next apart from that?
Well, the next album is going to be Gold Records Volume 1, which is good because that picks up a lot of stuff like Hound Dog and all these huge hits that weren't on albums. But between Loving You and Gold Records Volume 1 is Jailhouse Rock, which doesn't have an album, just has an EP, but it's a really good movie and a really good EP. So we could do a short episode covering that.
What do we got on the EP? 5 tracks.
Yeah. And again, there's a movie. If you want to watch the movie, it's a really good one. Like I promise you, I won't make you watch anything after The Army, but I'm telling you, the first three Elvis movies really are, each one is better than the next. So Jailhouse Rock is well worth watching.
Okay, let's do that. I'll watch the movie. We'll do the EP.
Awesome.
Because even though it's only 5 tracks, we'll end up talking about the movie for a while, so that's fine.
Exactly.
Okay, you heard it here first. Jailhouse Rock next.
Looking forward to it.
The B-side, Young and Beautiful, which is also the name of a Prince track, interestingly.
Is it?
Isn't that on that One Night Alone piano?
It is.
I think it's Young and Beautiful.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's all. We're done. That's a bit of a long one, but that's fine.
It's our first movie. So.
Yeah, so that's why. We talked about the movie. So, we'll see you next time. That's the end.
Thanks, everybody.
We've talked enough.
We definitely have.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Elvis has left the building.
Fifty-eight.